Good afternoon. From the KTOO Newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumery. Thank you for tuning in. An evacuation advisory remains in effect for Juneau's Barron's Avalanche Path downtown for a fifth day. But now, the city and borough of Juneau's evacuation alert is using more urgent language. Today at 11 a.m., the city issued a new advisory saying that the risk of large avalanches is increasing significantly and will be highest Tuesday and into Wednesday morning. That's because heavy rain, high winds, and warmer temperatures can destabilize the deep snowpack on Mount Juneau. The Centennial Hall emergency shelter remains open. The city urges people in the Barron's pathway who have not evacuated or have returned to their homes to evacuate immediately. Thane Road closed again today at noon due to the heightened risk of avalanches. The closure will be reevaluated at 6 a.m. on Wednesday. Good afternoon. You're listening to KTOO. I'm Yvonne Crumery. Thank you for tuning in. The Juneau Assembly agreed last night to cover the shortfall by pulling money from lower priority city projects. But not everyone was on board. KTOO's Clarice Larson tells us more.
According to city administration, it's expected to cost $20.5 million to purchase, renovate, and move into the two floors of the Michael J. Burns Building, which houses the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation downtown. The floors are slated to become Juneau's new City Hall location. In September, the Juneau Assembly greenlit the purchase of the floors from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Mayor Beth Weldon says the move to the Burns Building is the best option for both city staff and citizens.
We have to find a solution. We have looked under every rock to find a cheaper solution. There is no cheaper solution.
Those rocks include trying to build a new city hall and looking at existing buildings like the current U-Haul building in Lemon Creek, Marie Drake Building, and the Floyd Dryden campus. The $20.5 million price tag is millions of dollars higher than city officials anticipated it would be just a few months ago. That cost is to cover moving expenses and a partial remodel of the floors, including things like new paint, carpet, and cubicles. And while the Assembly has already put aside about $14.5 million for a City Hall project during recent budget cycles, they still needed to find another $6 million. So at a meeting on Monday, Assembly members agreed to pay for that shortfall by pulling that amount from a hodgepodge of other proposed city projects, including the Capitol Civic Center, the Lemon Creek Multimodal Pathway, and a waterfront museum. But not everyone was in favor of the plan. New Assembly member Nano Brooks voted against the transfer of funds, arguing it was too much money.
The amount of $20 million is just, I can't support that in good conscience. It's not what the taxpayers voted for, and even the funds that were initially set aside has left a lot of the community feeling very disparaged and unheard.
The Assembly's vote comes after multiple years of push and pull between city administration and Juneau voters. The city asked voters twice during recent municipal elections to approve bond debt for new City Hall. They said no both times. Juneau's current City Hall near Marine Park fits less than half of the city's employees, and it needs millions of dollars in maintenance and repairs. The new Burns Building location would consolidate several departments that are now in separate buildings. Assemblymember Alicia Huskandes says the plan isn't perfect, but she'll support it.
There's no workable alternative that I have heard, and so we need to find the solution, and this is frequently where we find ourselves, which is just choosing the best of our least favorite choices.
According to city administration, the renovations and the move to the new City Hall location are expected to take at least a year to complete. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
And in May 2015, 23-year-old Bethel resident Eunice Whitman was killed. The next day, her boyfriend Justin Paul was arrested for her murder and spent the next 7 years behind bars without ever facing a trial. Then in 2022, Paul was released after the evidence that held up the prosecutor's case against him fell apart. Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica reporter Kyle Hopkins recently wrote about Whitman's murder and Paul's release. He told Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early that the incident speaks to wider issues within Alaska's justice system, involving delayed trials, shoddy investigations, and a lack of justice for rural communities.
I started looking at the story and was trying to understand how it would take 6 or 7 years for someone accused of murder to get to trial. You know, like, why were there so many delays? Like, because you do have a right to a speedy trial. Our process is supposed to move much more quickly. And so I was trying to understand why it took so long. And the more I learned about that, how common it was for cases to be delayed and delayed and delayed dozens of times, sometimes 5, 7, 10 years, that actually led me to write a bunch of stories before this one. Like this story set me on a path of writing maybe 6 other stories before this that had nothing to do with it, that were just purely about pretrial delay and this gridlock that we have in our Alaska courts.
So who was Eunice Whitman, and how did she die?
Eunice Whitman was, she was a 23-year-old woman from Bethel, also from McCoryuk. She had been living in Bethel, you know, long enough that she had gone to like the UBIC immersion school there. And, you know, so a child of Bethel, growing up in Bethel, now a young woman living there. She died on May 24th, 2015, in what, you know, this one attorney who was familiar with the case described as kind of a, almost like a serial killer type of crime scene. And you know, I don't say that lightly. I mean, the point was, it was such an unusually like violent and public killing that it stood out among, you know, even in Alaska, where we unfortunately have high rates of homicide.
And how was Justin Paul identified as a suspect in Whitman's murder?
You know, if you're familiar with Bethel, there's the boardwalk that's kind of in the center of town. And she was found there. Her body was found there at about 4 a.m. on a Sunday morning. And then so police arrive and they rope it off, and it's a crime scene throughout the day. And then that evening, Eunice's boyfriend, this guy named Justin Paul, called 911 and said that he was looking. I mean, he was aware that there was a body in the center of town. Like everyone in town knew because it was so public. And he called 911 saying that he was worried that that was his, what he called his fiance, but certainly his girlfriend. And he said, you know, I'm worried it's Eunice Whitman. And the police said, at that point, they had not identified the body. And they said, well, why don't you come to the police department and we'll talk about it. And so he comes to the police department about 6:30 p.m. on that Sunday, and then just doesn't leave. He's kind of behind bars for the next 6 or 7 years.
And why did it take so long for his case to be dismissed, despite what you write is kind of a lack of evidence?
Some evidence was presented to this grand jury that suggested that, you know, the police said, look, this is the boyfriend of the woman who died. We found a backpack at his house where he was staying, and it was full of bloody clothes. And we think the blood on those clothes is going to connect him to this murder. So from the grand jury's perspective, it's a really damning case. It seems like a slam dunk of a case. But the problem was, when that evidence started to be tested at the crime lab, you know, they send that evidence down to Anchorage to be tested. Well, the blood, it didn't match her DNA. It was his own DNA. So that evidence fell apart really early. And meantime, there are other people, other potential suspects that were not like aggressively investigated. There are people certainly in Bethel who feel that police had the right person. The detective who led that investigation for Bethel Police, she thinks he did it. The victim's family, they think he did it, right? But the problem with the way that this played out through the police investigation and the courts is that the steps were not taken to exclude and kind of close the door systematically to these other likely suspects. And so years later, the case gets thrown out and no one is served, right? You have a defendant who, if innocent, was kept robbed of his freedom for 7 years. And if guilty, as in the eyes of the police detective, well, that case was dismissed, right? So justice was served to no one.
So with Paul released, you write that the case has gone back basically to square one and the state's missing and murdered Indigenous persons unit has taken over. Has the unit had much luck in solving any of these cases?
You know, I have a line in the story, one of the stories, that says that they have not solved a cold case homicide in their tenure, since they were created. So they've been around 3 years. They haven't made an arrest in a cold case MMIP homicide, which, you know, I was careful with that fact. I think, to be fair, to provide context, what they would say is that they've been hard at work. They said they've been working their butts off on these cases, and that they've done other things like help connect families who had, you know, lost track of someone, who a family member had gone missing, and like reconnected people who had been, you know, lost track of each other and, you know, had relatives who they could no longer find. So they said, look, we've had successes, but just not yet in the arena of, you know, making an arrest on one of these cases.
What does this case say broadly about the justice system in Alaska?
For the people who believe that police did have the right person, they're not satisfied because it never even got to a trial because there were so many problems with, frankly, like the investigation and the way that the case was handled in the courts. One big takeaway for me was I think we all assume that this process works better than it does because we've all seen a bunch of Law and Order and we're like, yeah, you know, someone gets arrested and then they're going to go to trial. And if the evidence shows they didn't do it in the first 10 minutes and that person excluded, now we're on to the next suspect. And like, no, I mean, you can be indicted on an assumption. And then when the lab results kind of blow up that assumption, you're not necessarily going to be released. I mean, maybe you are if you have resources and you could pay for like a private attorney and who's aggressive, but you know, not necessarily. Like you might spend years in jail until they get sorted out.
Kyle Hopkins is a reporter with the Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica. His story can be read at ADN.com. And the United States Supreme Court has once again declined to take up challenges to a federal law that protects subsistence hunting and fishing in Alaska. The court rejected the state of Alaska's petition to review a federal lawsuit against the state over salmon management on the Kuskokwim River in southwest Alaska. The state had argued the federal government was misinterpreting a law Congress passed to protect a rural priority for subsistence. Last year, after the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals sided with federal fishery managers, the state asked the Supreme Court to take up the case. But in a court docket on Monday, the Supreme Court denied the state's position. The Alaska Federation of Natives hailed the decision. Its president, Ben Mallott, says decades of hard-won protections under the landmark Katie John lawsuits were also on the line.
I feel relieved that we don't have to spend our limited resources and efforts fighting for what we know is right. Hopefully, our final time protecting what Katie John fought for.
John was an Atna Athabascan elder who fought for the right to fish on rivers that flowed through federal lands. It's the third time the Supreme Court has declined to disturb the Katie John litigation. The federal government's Kuskokwim lawsuit, which the court has left to stand, now affirms similar protections. Alaska Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang said in a statement that the state will respect the decision of the Supreme Court. This is KTOO.